Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome back to another exciting episode of E on the Go. On today's episode, I want to cover something near and dear to my heart. Impromptu. Being impromptu, being just on the spot and making something up. That is what I'm doing right now. I am making this up on the spot. Currently, there is no guest. No one would like to be on the show. There is not one person in the world who wants to have a show with me. Well, there are a few people, and I'm trying to get them. I'm trying to get episodes out there, but for right now, it's just me, E, and I am on the go. Where am I going, you might ask? I'm going to a good old place up north called St. Louis. St. Louis for E. On the go. I'm beating a dead horse, but I want to know that I love you all, and I hope you're all doing pretty well, and I'm free associating, and there really should be structure and plan to this, but there isn't, just yet. But in the future, what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about chemical processing that might happen in the world. Fun things in science. Science breakthroughs, if you will. Fun things that occur in science. Well, they might not be fun, but they might be like, I don't know, a breakthrough of some sort. I don't know. So that was just me trying to allow someone to go. And I waved for them. And they sat and looked at me. Apparently, driving etiquette has gone out the window. It's gone. We don't even use blinkers anymore. Ladies and gentlemen, I was traveling the other day, and somebody just cuts right in front of me without using a blinker. I want you to know, ladies and gentlemen, if you out there operate a motorized vehicle, there is a handy-dandy little handle to the left of your steering wheel. Or you might have one of those fucking weird European cars that's on the right. I don't know. But on most cars, even on my black BMW 328D, it has a little handle that goes up and down. Coolest thing that you could see in the world, right? Because here's the deal. If you're going right, you push that thing up, and it tells literally everyone. Like the guy in front of me, I see him now. He's taking a right-hand turn. How perfect. Thank you for being an example, sir. In the silver Jeep. Good for you. I am really glad that you did that. Because it told me that I need to slow down. I need to slow down because this dude is about to turn. See, it tells you what you're thinking. And it's a way by which you can communicate to other drivers. If I want to get in the left lane, if I say, fuck this shit, I don't want the slow lane anymore, I'm getting in the fast lane. I've got a BMW, bitch. I'm putting this shit in sport mode. So I throw that thing in sport and I fucking turn on my blinker first. And then get in the left lane. It is literally so easy. All you have to do is use that handy-dandy little handle, flip it up or down, and it'll tell every single driver what you're doing. In fact, your hand should be in the exact location where that thing is. If your hands are in the right place, if you're holding the steering wheel where it is meant to be held, your hand is literally right next to it. Like, you could hit the handle as you are thinking about turning the steering wheel, like, it could be so easy. Where do things go wrong? See, I have to drop my IQ at least about 20 to 30 points to really put myself in the position of someone who thinks, oh, you know what? I'll just go in the other lane. They'll figure it out. They'll understand. Here's the deal. No, they won't. People come out of nowhere. Literally nowhere. You might not see everybody there. If you put on your blinker, and let's just say you have to get into the left lane, right? But you don't see the car in the left lane. Car in the left lane sees you, throws on its horn. It's like, hey, whoa there, Buster. Or puts on its brakes, slows down a bit. So the other car can actually react and prevent accidents in that way. Blinkers are fucking awesome. But let's drop our IQ points. Let's all of us right now, drop our IQ points down 20 to 30 points. Here's the thing about IQ. It's an average. So if we all drop it 20 to 30 points, then we end up right where we started. But just follow along. Someone stay still, but everyone else shift. It still doesn't work, but anyway. Come along with me to a journey into the mind of someone who is so careless and lazy that they don't give a fuck who is in the left lane. They know that bitch is empty. They have a full understanding of where they are in time and space. Because, you know, obviously everyone else is dumb and they are the smart one. Just like the people who take this idea on, you know, it's the street smarts, ladies and gentlemen, street smarts, and we're driving on streets, and we gotta be smart about it, right? Right? Who cares about that book smarts when you got street smarts? So, what do we do with our street smarts? Well, we just fucking twirl our wheel, right? We just twist our wheel, we get in the left lane, because who fucking cares who's there? Now, why would I want to do this? Well, I got to get over there quicker, right? I don't have time to let people know I got to get in the left lane. I have to get over there. This guy's being real slow, he's being a douche, and he flipped me off earlier. So I can't just let this person know I'm about to pass them. Like, they might get in the left lane. I don't know, they might speed up. Who knows what could happen? I'm putting on my blinker. Right? Well, I mean, honestly, what's the worst that could happen? Here's this one. You put on your blinker to get in the left lane. Homeboy in left lane speeds up. And goes, not today. Not in front of me. I have a white fucking Mazda. Do you know who I am? I am KRG681, please. In the white fucking Mazda. Jesus Christ. This thing has four cylinders, okay? Four cylinders of internal combustion, of pure power. It's fucking going. And I can't have no fucking black BMW coming in front of me. Who do you think you are, pal? I'm the white fucking Mazda. You're not getting in front of me. I need to make it to that red light 2 seconds faster. That's my red light. I'm in this position. Okay, I might be beating this dead horse right now, but I want to illuminate the ridiculousness of if you are in the left lane and someone wants to get in the left lane and you speed up, fuck you, and you need to know you have super low IQ, and here's why. Because if you speed up to someone who says, hi, I'm about to get in the left lane, and you get in their spot to get in the left lane, dude in the right lane might not see you just sped up. He might go, okay, getting in the left lane now, and goes into the left lane and fucking hits your car. You know what they call that? They call that an accident, you stupid fuck. So, do you want to get in an accident? In fact, that is not an accident when you deliberately cause a car to run into you. That is insurance fraud. It's a big crime. And when you get a car like mine that's got dash cams and it has cameras on it, you don't get away with it. No, no, no. Please. You actually get sued in court.
Oh, I can't pay that.
Fuck you. Listen. You've got a job. I know you do. We're going to garnish your wages, you stupid fuck. Like, that's how this system works. You don't get away with stupid shit like that. Not if you're dealing with someone who covers their bases, who documents their things, and can argue their case in a court of law. No, no, no. Sorry. That's a stupid action. That's why your IQ's real low if you do that. I'm not just calling someone stupid because, you know, they're another person. It's just, by your very action, you are doing a very stupid thing. And you could very well not do that thing. It is very easy not to press on the... It's very easy to not accelerate when someone clearly needs to get over. Because you don't know why they're getting over. You don't know if they need a turn right away. If something just happened spontaneously, and now I need to get in the fucking margin because my tires popped. If you, like, block someone else from entering in, what you're doing is you're standing in the way of progress. You're standing in the way of cooperation. And what does that make you? It makes you a stupid fuck who's not set out to operate in this society. Like, so we're going to garnish your wages because you're dumb. That's how that works. And again, if you're out there, this podcast is sponsored by dash cams. Dash cams, ladies and gentlemen, get them while they're hot or while you are hot on the wire running from the police. Think to yourself, maybe I can argue this in a court of law. Instead of pulling me over and saying, you were going 34 and a 30, you could say, your device has a large margin of error, sir, and my car was in fact not going 34, it was going 30, I've got a dash cam, I'm going to argue this in a court of law, blah, 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 you do your thing. So, the general gist of this is, first of all, use your blinker. It is the mode of communication that you have in a vehicle. It is one of two things that you can do. I mean, really three, but it really depends on whether or not they can see you. Number one of communication is honk. Honk, honk. And, like, I don't know if there's, like, a Morse code for honking. I haven't figured it out. But, in fact, I rarely use that. Even when someone's clearly at the fucking red light. And I'm like, come on, dude. Like, I'll speed up behind them and be like, yo, we're inching. What are you doing? But you could honk if you really wanted to. If you wanted to. I'd try not to do that. I don't like being honked at. But if I do honk at you, it's a light honk. It's a nice tap. It's like a beep. Like, hey. Hey. What are you doing? If you bleed into my lane right in front of me without using your blinker, bet your ass I'm honking at you, because why in the fuck are you taking my space up? What are you doing? Tell me you're turning. So, guys, really, use method number two of communication in a motorized vehicle, the blinker. Left or right, which way are you going? You going straight? Don't use any of them then. Don't confuse people. I get way more mad at people who don't use their blinker than those who leave their blinker on. Because it's like, if you leave your blinker on and it's like, hey, I'm turning, and you don't turn ever, then, I mean, it's unfortunate because I'm like waiting for you to turn and you don't do it. But I don't get angry. I'm just like, oh, come on, man, like, pay attention, what are you doing? But if you deliberately just shift lanes, multiple lanes, and I saw this the other day, dude, gets in the left lane, gets in the other left lane, because, like, he's on a multi-lane highway, if you will, gets back in the first left lane that he turned into, and then gets into the rightmost lane, all without using his blinker. So I was like, whoa, and I flashed at him. I'm like, I saw that. No, no. I passed by, dude flips me off. And I'm like, okay, so I'm the asshole. I'm the asshole here. So I'm just the dude saying, hey, what are you doing? So, like, so that makes me the asshole, because I wasn't the one swerving in between traffic without using a blinker. and then there's some asshole who has the audacity to find that to be a poor action. I don't know. It's times like that that make me want to, like, have some sort of, like 22 or something, just, like, chilling in my car to be like, what the fuck? Like, and just, I don't know, make it so that someone has learns from this experience, because it's just, like, it's awful. When someone just swerves all around the road, and you're like, hey, what are you doing? And they clearly don't give a fuck what you're saying. How are they going to learn that? I mean, you obviously can't bring up the issue because you're the fucking asshole who's doing it. So what do? Children, the answer is violence. You have to use violence. Vigilante justice is appropriate and morally acceptable, if not required. So that was like a... It was sort of a joke. That was sort of a joke there, but it sounded really serious. But at the same time, it's like, guys, what are you doing? What are you doing? No, it is not justified to kill someone over that stupid action, but why are you doing that? Why are you doing that to begin with? Is your life, like, that shitty? And the only reason why I'm, like, particularly pent up about this subject is because I've seen it far too often in this recent time frame. In the very recent time frame, I've seen more often than not, like, I'm driving down 55 quite often, and 270 is one of the worst, but it's like, when I am driving, I see this at least 4 or 5 times with every trip. Like, this, it shouldn't be the case. You should be using your blinker, like, all of the time. You should always use your blinker. There's never a reason why you shouldn't. So that brings me to my second fucking sponsor, bumper stickers, ladies and gentlemen. It says, it's a little light bulb, and it says, and he's got, like, a little light bulb on his butt, and it's, like, lighting up, and it says, don't be a stinker, use your blinker, and it, like, points to the blinker. You know, if you guys would like one, I'm selling them for $3 a piece. Like my Facebook, like my small business Facebook, and we'll send them out to you. Don't be a stinker, use your blinker. It's a bumper sticker now. Sorry, this is going off on a tangent, but it's kind of a tangent that I really wanted to get out there anyway. Like, if you're out there and you're using your blinker, I fucking love you. Thank you for doing that. Every single time I see it, I'm like, thank God. Like, someone is obeying the goddamn law and doing this. And as much as I like breaking the law, as much as I like looking at things and saying, like, okay, how can I get around that law? Or what can I do to make it so that what I'm actually doing is legal, but generally considered as illegal, you know, like bending the law, things like that. Like, white collar crime fascinates me, right? It's not something that I would do, but it's like, to know the loopholes that exist within the system excite me, because it's like cheat codes. It's like little life cheat codes that we have for our society. And if you can find those little tiny things that, like, either get you out of something or make it so that, like, you are breaking the law but no one really finds out. Like, I love those ideas.
the whole theory behind them. I don't like actually doing them. I feel completely paranoid and completely nervous, and like I don't break the law. But at the same time, I love thinking about breaking the law. So it's like, it's this dichotomy that I exist with. And everything just kind of exists in my mind at the moment. It's not something that I'm going to act on, but it's like, how do I make that illegal chemical? And how do I make that chemical slightly different so that it has the same effects, but it's not illegal? You know, there's always loopholes. There's always, like, ways you can get around things. And the more you know those little loopholes, the more you can just devour the world's information and just eat it all up like popcorn. The more tools you have to play with on a day-by-day basis, the more words you can use, the better you can get your point across when trying to communicate. That can sometimes get you into trouble because you're struggling to find the words that others struggle to understand. So sometimes you use a word that's a little more complicated that actually gets to your point a lot better. It's more concise, and it utilizes a word that's not often used, and therefore it displays your variety of vocabulary. It displays your lexicon, if you will, of speech. But sometimes people, and I would say more often than not, people don't understand the more complicated yet more accurate words that you say. So even though that you know substantially more than the others around you, you can't exactly connect to them. And a lot of the times what you have to do is you have to display your idea to others. You have to communicate this abstract scientific perspective and like divvy it up into little parts and give it analogies that aren't exactly correct but kind of get to the point. And you have to give that to people. So in science communication, it can be a little tricky because much of the time you're not accurately telling people what your thing is, but more people accept it because it's less accurate but more easily uptaken. You know, for example, when we talk about atoms, right? When we first talk about atoms, we say, well, you know, everything is made of matter. You never really return to this whole concept, like, way later in chemistry or physics. But, you know, they describe this thing called matter. And they say, all things are made of matter. You know? And it seems a little silly when they say it like that. But that's how they put it to, like, the most basic students of science, and you can think of it in that way, and you can say, oh yeah, all things are made of matter, right? That makes sense, and it makes sense to the second grader. But then they say, okay, well, what is matter made of? What is matter? How do we define matter? And it gets a little tricky, you know, like, okay, well, what is matter? Like, I've studied science for a very long time, and I struggle to find a definition for matter. It might just be because I'm stupid, or it might just be because it's something so vague and so inaccurate that we never really return to it. You know, and to say that all things are made of stuff, it's basically what we're saying. You know, words are just words, and we have to find some sort of definition for it, right? So when we look at something like matter, right, it's just these little, you can picture them as like beads, little granule sand bits that make up everything. You know, all things are made up of these very tiny little things that encompass everything. And that's what we call matter. From what I remember, you know, I haven't seen that definition since I was like in fifth grade, so it's a little hard for me. But then we get into the atom, and then we say, okay, well, matter really is mainly consisted of these little things called atoms, you know, and then the student says, okay, well, what is an atom? And you say, well, it's the most indivisible part of a certain element, right? You could say that all things are made of these things called elements. These things that we call elements, and we break them down into their single units, and those little single units are called atoms. It's the most indivisible part of all matter, right? And that's what the word atom comes from. It comes from a term meaning indivisible. Problem is that you can actually divide up the atom. So you can divide up the indivisible thing, which is actually a little funny to me and ironic, but you can look at the different particles inside this atom. You can look at the nucleus, right? What does the nucleus have? The nucleus has protons and it has neutrons. The proton is a positively charged sphere. And those positively charged spheres also contain juxtaposed to it, which means like kind of like right next to it, juxtaposed to these positively charged spheres, you have these neutrally charged spheres. And those are called neutrons. And those both stick together to make up the complete weight of an atom. These two things have weight, and only the proton has a charge. And then we say, okay, well, there's this little thing called an electron, which is negatively charged, and that encircles the atom, kind of like an orbit, you know? And then we start talking about it as if it's like a planetary orbit. We start talking about it as if these electrons are orbiting the thing, almost like a gravitational pull. See this often with like the Big Bang Theory logo. Like that is this electron orbiting a nucleus, right? And that's how we can think of it, as like the electron actually being this object that is like floating around this atom in a circular motion. At this point, hopefully physics students are like, hey, listen, pal, orbits are ellipses. To which point I say, you're right, you're absolutely right. But the way we think about, like, electron orbits are very circular for some reason. Only at that stage. And then we say, well, that's not actually that accurate, you know? Because, actually, these little orbits, it doesn't really go from one orbit to the other in this continuous manner. It's actually, like, discrete jumps from one to the other. And in fact, all of these electrons exist within this quantized cloud of electron density, in which we only depict the probability with which we would find an electron in any particular point. And this is like extremely beyond any fifth grader, right? But this is something that maybe a freshman college student can get. Because this is something that we actually this is something we bring up in general chemistry in CH185. This is something that like your introductory chemistry course will bring up. So it's definitely something that freshmen in college can understand, but it's something that like you don't get a complete grip on until you move on to, say, physical chemistry. And then in physical chemistry, which is the one I'm in now, you start to say, okay, well, you know, these electrons are in these quantized state, and like quantum mechanics is inexorably tied to these things called wave functions. And you have wave functions and eigenvalues, and I don't actually completely understand that right now, and I hope to be able to communicate that in a better way later on. But when we talk about these wave functions and eigenvalues, what we do is we take like an we take a eigenvalue and we put it through an operator. And sorry, maybe it's an eigenfunction. And we put it through an operator and we get an eigenvalue back. And if we get like if we get the same thing back multiplied by some sort of coefficient, then we know that we have an eigenvalue. It's like, it's beyond me, it really is, but it's not something that like explicitly conforms to what we were talking about before. We really get into the nitty-gritty of like, what is an electron and where do I find it in this probability cloud? It gets really nitty-gritty here, and if you gave that most specific thing to a second grader, like, they would go completely blank almost immediately. So when we talk about scientific things, we really have to start out with these little bits that aren't exactly accurate, that really don't depict something as it actually is. But what our archetypical minds can attach to, what our narrative-seeking brains can latch our hooks onto. We look for illustrations. We look for colorful descriptions of reality. We don't look for the numerical value of something. Not innately. It's very hard for us to completely understand numbers. The way I personally do it is I actually break numbers down into a very physical, in a very physical way. I actually picture the number one as one object, or I picture the number two as two separate entities, or the number three is the same thing. And when we're adding, we're taking these spheres and we're mashing them together, basically. We're taking these little tiny spheres and we're combining them. And so, like, say we have 3 plus 4. I'm picturing 3 spheres and, like, 4 spheres. And then we combine those and we make 7. And I just see that. And then if we subtract, what I do is I color the spheres something differently. And then I superimpose them and see whatever's left. Like, I see numbers in a very colorful manner, and I actually try and picture things very colorfully and illustratively. And I feel like this intuition is the best way that you can actually perceive things going forward, especially when you get into things like analytical geometry. And so when you get into like calculus, what you deal with a lot are these graphs. You do a lot of graphical analysis. And if I picture like 1 over x, I can actually see the graph. I see the graph that it makes. And it's really important, and this is why they stress this in pre-calculus. The pictures of graphs. What does 1 over x look like? What does e to the x look like? What does the logarithm of x look like? When I'm saying these things, I'm actually actively illustrating every single graph in my mind. And it's extremely important to do so whenever you get into more complicated things. This will allow you an intuition that is out of view for most students, because most students will just take a specific set of things and get good at memorizing them, for one, and then get good at memorizing what the products of that thing are. So if I can apply this to like mathematics, if you just remember what the logarithm of 2 is, or sorry, the natural logarithm of 2, then what get people who remember long strings of numbers. Which is totally fine if you're like, if the max of your, if the max of your mathematical understanding is to pass the test and like, hopefully either waive or do adequate on your final because you're not going to remember it. Totally fine if you want to do that. If you want to just say you know something and don't actually know it, you can actually do that as well. Or you could be the special type of scientist that actually makes fun of others, throws others under the bus, cannot think for themselves, and will laugh at new ideas when presented because they can do no independent thinking whatsoever. I know these scientists very well. I see them in action when they do this. And it depresses me every time because I have this quote, I think it's from Albert Einstein, but it is as followed. He who is a scientist, who is not simultaneously a philosopher, a poet, a painter, an artist, is not a true scientist. He is a monkey on a keyboard, typing the greatest works of Shakespeare accidentally. I think this is a really important quote because not only does it like elicit that image of monkeys on a keyboard. If anyone knows that analogy, it comes from, I forgot who said it, but it's this whole infinite, it's this potential with infinity. And it's that if you have monkeys on a keyboard and you somehow teach like an infinite amount of monkeys to type on a keyboard, as we all know, monkeys are sporadic. They're very random. They just type a bunch of random nonsense. So if you put a large amount of them on keyboards, the vast majority, 99.999 into infinitum, I don't know what that word is, but to infinity, you would have that amount just typing the most random stream of numbers and letters and symbols. But there is a probability that there will be one monkey who types the entire works of Shakespeare all in a row. Now, this is extremely improbable, like one over a massive number. So it's going to be almost impossible to find this monkey if you had to peruse through all of them, but there will be exactly one out of a certain amount who will type the entire works of Shakespeare accidentally. And here's the beautiful thing I love about that. It also applies the whole concept that we all are basically evolved monkeys, right? It's not exactly monkeys. And like I said, these analogies aren't perfect. They're not exactly correct. But you can think of it as us having come from these great apes, from the ancestors that they all come from. So, if you think about us as just this random happenstance of monkeys who have found themselves to greater and higher consciousness and the ability to create things in the way that we do, you can think of us as monkeys on a keyboard. Monkeys who are just typing away at whatever was given to us. You know, those who just simply conform to the world around us will go far. They really will. And especially if you can emulate the most successful people, you will also have a great deal of success. If you take the habits, the thoughts, the daily activities of the most successful people in the world, in your opinion, in your definition of success. If you take those most important people and you copy exactly their daily routine, within reason, you will find success. You definitely will. There's a large amount of luck that goes along with it. Sure is. Being in the right place at the right time goes a long way. But if you can incorporate their daily habits into your own life and copy it completely, you'll have a lot of success. But what you're going to be doing is just copying the works of others. You're not going to be able to think for yourself as an independent thinker and do things for a reason. You're doing things for habit. You're doing them because someone else found success doing it. It's the person in the lab who's looking around at what others are doing rather than reading their own lab manual. And I see this God knows how many times, but people often will look to others for quicker answers rather than doing the harder option of reading the lab manual. And I am most certainly guilty of this as well. I'm not saying that I am holier than thou. It is something that I find myself doing quite often, and I hate when I do it because I know it's detrimental to my education. So, what are we then? What are we than just looking at the great works of Shakespeare as these dumb monkeys and just typing it word or letter for letter? Now, that's much more probable than typing it out accidentally, sure. But if we're just copying word for word these great works, what are we? What are we but just plagiarizers instead of playwrights? And life is a stage. All of life is a drama. It's a play that we're putting on for others. And within our own minds, we are living out the archetypes that we have taken up throughout life. And I love this analogy to monkeys on a keyboard for that exact reason. Because we all are poets at heart. We're all playwrights. We're all artists. Whether that be through words or whether that be through rhymes. Whether that be through a paintbrush, or whether that be through science, you can allow your mind to take in these ideas and make unique, novel connections. You know, the way to most efficiently do this is to induce yourself with lysergic acid diethylamide, and it allows you to make these unique connections to things you've never even thought about connecting before. You know, what is the taste of red? What does blue really look like? You know, what that state allows you to do is it allows you to rediscover components of the world as an adult. We all look at these things with the mental models that we made as children. These mental molds that we have created and just have stuck with through convention. But if anyone knows child development, it's not like our parents were perfect. I love my parents. I thought they were great. You know, like, I had a really good childhood. I didn't have the best childhood. I could have had, like, parents that really stressed, I don't know, reading and reading comprehension. I feel like that's a place where I could do better now, but you know, that's what rediscovery is all about. That's why we are allowed so many fucking years to just discover whatever we'd like. Just because my parents didn't stress that doesn't mean that I can't read a fuck ton now that I know that that's something that's extremely crucial, especially if you want to make it into grad school. So, yeah, all of our parents weren't perfect. That's just how it goes. Childhood for all of us is not perfect. Unless you have, like, psychologists as parents. Those who can really read your mind and allow you to develop in the most efficient manner. And even then, they're probably very hard workers. you know, and they're probably absent from home a great deal of time. So, no one's perfect. Nobody is perfect. And we have to accept that. And we have to think, okay, well, how can I myself train the way in which I know about the world? And something that you can do is discover the psychedelics, to discover the way in which you can break things down to their most fundamental core and see for the second time an object right in front of you that has always been there, but you are now looking upon it with the naked eye. You're not masking it with your consciousness. You're not masking it with anything that says, oh, yeah, that is a bird. You're looking at it with complete awe, thinking, my God, what are those feather-like things on this creature? This beautiful iridescent mix of red and blue. What is that magical thing they're doing to allow them to float in air? And we, of course, as reductionists say, well, of course, it's flight, you know, and their feathers have a particular wavelength. But, like, when you can rediscover the color red, when you can finally, for the first time, see metal for what it actually is, it's a beautiful fucking thing. Absolutely life-changing. It allows your mental connections to become more efficient. And it allows for ideas that have never been formed before. I look at my life in my writings before these experiences and think, wow, I really did see the world in such a different way. And I don't know if it's through... It's through a composite, really. It's through a mixture of you know, those experiences along with the discovery of Jordan Peterson and how to restructure the mind. And even, say, just Joe Rogan bringing in countless guests. And I siphon through most of, like, the bullshittery and the archers and the MMA guys or whatever. Like, I love MMA. It's cool. I just don't like to hear about it for 2 hours. I love to watch it. I just don't like to hear about the stats. You know, it's some people like that, and that's totally cool. Like, that's Joe's shtick. I love Joe Rogan, but, like, I'll look for doctors, Dr. Rhonda Patrick. I'll look for the recent Harvard geneticist that was on there who spoke about certain genetic predispositions to diseases. And he spoke about the genetic role of aging, for instance. And it's like these profound thinkers that you're able to listen to from a distance. And you have absolutely no obligation to offer your own opinion, offer your own shitty opinion, for lack of a better word. Like, if I am a little bit scared to seek out my professors, because my professors know so much. It's unbearable how much they know about something. And so to approach this doctor and say, I really don't get entropy. You know, like, it's terrifying, because it's not that they come at you with, like, a force. It's not like they're like, oh, how dare you not know this? You know, like, they don't get mad. They come at you with such intense truth, such intense knowledge, and it's a powerful thing to be in front of. And then you walk away feeling immensely stupid, because you're like, oh, well, that was obvious to them. And so oh boy, oh my, I have forgotten what I was saying here. Thank you. So to be in front of someone with such profound information is scary to you. It's a little bit frightening, and only because you don't know what to offer. It's like you're in the presence and you're taking up so much, and you have absolutely nothing to offer in return. In contrast, when you listen to, say, a podcast of your choosing, it might be Sam Harris, it might be the Dr. Rhonda Patrick podcast, it might be Tim Ferriss, even, it might be Radiolab. Like, there are so many different podcasts that you could listen to that have such a good quality in their production. Definitely not mine, but those who really engage in the learning process there, in inviting guests on that have compelling things to say, and then asking good questions while they're on their podcast. And Joe Rogan definitely got me into the whole world of podcasting, but, you know, after finding the various different people that were on his show, you then get a broader view of what is available. And, you know, life just hasn't been the same after you experience so much of that. After you listen to Ryan Holiday's book about the obstacle being the way, or reading or listening to Jocko Willink's book about discipline equaling freedom. It's life-changing to encounter books like Grit by Angela Duckworth that says, you know, don't just give up on a problem, stick to it. And in the stick-to-itiveness that you have is a characteristic known as grit. It's to stick to something despite the failures. And success is directly correlated to your ability to obtain grit and cultivate grit. Mindset is another one by, that's not Angela Duckworth, but it's by, oh wow, I don't know if that's Barbara Oakley. I know she wrote another book, but if that's Barbara Oakley, that's awesome. But there's a book called Mindset that basically shows this whole idea that you are not a fixed mind. You are not someone who's either smart or stupid. You're someone who might start out real dumb, but you can actually cultivate this skill of intelligence, of grabbing new ideas and applying them. That's something that you can actually build. It's not something that you're fixed with. You know, so to encounter something like that is absolutely profound. Reading Outliers was also something that very much stuck out to me, where practice makes perfect. You know, putting your 10,000 hours into practicing a certain skill. And like Jocko says, that discipline that you put into that skill set will set you free. You're not going to feel like antsy all the time if you put all of that active energy that's just dissipating into the universe as paranoia, as a jitteriness when doing nothing. You put it actively into a skill and actively learn and engage yourself with the world around you within arm's reach. That gives you the ability to actually set you free and allow you to do pretty much anything that you want to do. Because to cultivate the skill set of charisma is to communicate your ideas more effectively. It's to articulate your ideas in a more effective manner. And it's something that I definitely need to work on. But it's a skill that you can cultivate. And even if you are introverted, even if you are someone who doesn't typically like to articulate your ideas in a verbal format, to do so just to practice on your route, say, to school even, is an essential skill to have. So, I don't know, these different books, these different experiences have brought a new perspective to my mind, and it's amazing how even just a year or two ago, I read some of the things that I have I read some of these things that I have put out into the universe, and I'm thinking, well, my God, like, I am such a different person from when I was writing that. And I don't know any mind-changing substance any better than, say, psilocybin mushrooms. Like, psilocybin mushrooms, lysergic acid, diethylamide, never DMT, but I feel like that's probably part of the list, too. And these substances are often abused, and I should mention that. I really should. These are tools that you can use to radically change your viewpoint and outlook on life. It's amazing how effective they are. But at the same time, at the very same time, there are people out there that abuse these substances. There are people out there that keep getting the same message and never learn from it. There are people that have profound experiences and walk away unchanged. Now, it's important not to point these people out because they know their own struggles. But if you continually learn from these powerful psychedelics but never apply that knowledge, it makes the experience useless, and it gives those substances a bad name. And I want to make it explicitly clear that while these substances are illegal, oh, by the way, if they're illegal wherever you're at and you're an officer of the law, I am portraying a character, and this is not, in fact, myself, and I shall remain nameless, even though I named myself earlier. I'm not actually admitting to the consumption of any of these, but I'm just saying, hypothetically, if I was a character portraying something, someone who had done this, this is what I would say. There are people out there that abuse these, and consistently indulge in the experience simply because it brings them outside of their own perspective and brings them to a place that is more preferred than the chaos that they live in. It's an unfortunate truth that we have degenerates among us that indulge themselves in these experiences and do nothing with them. And I don't want you to imagine those people when I talk about this. I don't want you to imagine those who hear the profound truth and then continue to lie. I don't want you to picture those people because they are not an accurate representation of what is available. When it comes to psychedelics, they can serve mankind in tremendous ways. Simply reading the works of Terence McKenna will allow you to see this. And the man puts things so he packs these abstract ideas so densely into his talks, but they are absolutely captivating for this reason, because it's a radical change of mindset, and it dramatically increases your ability to connect ideas that seem separate on the surface. But I want to get off of this topic as soon as I can, because I know it's a touchy topic for some, and so I'll stop this, but I just want to go on the mini tangent and say that psychedelics are not the bad thing. Psychedelics are not the bad people you associate them with. They serve a purpose, and I don't know how to make that point any more clear, other than Nikola Tesla, if, as we all know, Nikola Tesla, the man had these fits of images that would appear before him. He had these little bright flashes of light, as he called them. He soon then learned how to control them and started to imagine the abstract world before him. And he could actually manifest the abstract ideas that he was studying in front of him. So this actually served Nikola Tesla, the man who invented half the shit in your room right now. So if we could find something, if we could find a substance to similarly give this experience to the rest of mankind, think of what we could create as human beings. But that is the last point on the subject. Give a prime example of someone who benefited from this. Steve Jobs, even LSD was one of the most profound experiences of his life, etc., etc. Like, there are many examples of this, but like I said, I will get off the subject. I cannot stop thinking about Gabriel's horn. It is this idea, and this is like a completely different idea, but it's this mathematical principle, right? So we're going to get a little bit heavy on the mathematics. You can turn it off at this point if you don't like math. But as we know, with a book by Max Tegmark, who came out with something called The Mathematical Universe, it's a book that defines our entire universe as basically being mathematical. And basically what he does is he breaks down the various different parallel universes that we have within our that we have within our reality, basically. There are like level 1 universes, level 2 universes, level 3 universes, and so on. And it gets to, I think, level 4 or level 5, and at which point he starts to say that everything is purely mathematical. If you, there's this thing with mathematics where you think everything's good, you're like, you're taking numbers, you're pushing them together, and you're like, yeah, this is cool, I totally get it. And then someone's like, what's 4x plus 3? And you're like, oh, shit. And they're like, define x. What is x? And obviously, 4x plus 3, you move the 3 over to the other side of the equation, and then you divide both sides by 4, so it's negative 3/4. Like, duh. It's basically whatever you put in the equation to make it 0. So then we get into algebra, basically. That's what it means to, like, hide a variable. It's algebra. And then you get, it gets a little confusing, but still manageable. And then you get into trigonometry. Or rather, I think you embrace geometry first. It gets a little weird with, like, angles. You kind of get it. And then you get a little more advanced in algebra. And then they throw trigonometry at you. And then you further develop your angles, and then you get into calculus, pre-calculus, really, to give you the whole foundation of graphical analysis and seeing, like, what the graphs look like and what is that difference quotient. And then you start talking about calculus, and calculus just throws a fucking wrench in things. Calculus is like, yeah, what is the change in the function? You know, ergo, what is the derivative? Now, what that is it's basically, to define a derivative is to say that you're defining the change in a function at a very small point. So that's where, like, difference quotients come into, and difference quotients are super fucking easy. Like, don't tune out because of this. Don't turn off your podcast because, like, you don't want to hear the words associated with this. Like, try and picture it with me. Just really try and picture it. It's like a graph that's looking like it's curving upwards, right? And for you to say, okay, what is the change at any point in this function? A change is like, what is the rise over the run? You know, like, it's basically, what's the slope? Like, it's super, it's pretty easy. But what you do is you, like, you draw a line from one point in the curve, and then you draw it to another point in the curve, and you say, okay, there's the slope. There's a slope between these two points. And then what you do is you bring those points closer and closer together until the points are practically the same thing. And then you get a slope at a single point. That is called a tangent, right? That's what we call as a tangent. So if you, like, say if you fly off the handle, if you fly off the slope, if you fly off, like, the point of discussion, you go off into a tangent. That's what we say, right? And that's what that essentially is. It's a tangent. It's going off on a tangent. Kind of like the thing that I'm doing now to explain mathematics to actually get to this principle that I'm talking about. But, that's basically like calculus. It's defining the change in a function. And then whenever you can integrate that change and get your function back, plus a C, an unknown C. It's like, I'm trying to be specific, but also, sorry, broad, but also correct, and it's a little bit challenging, but, you know, that's when it comes into, like, derivatives and integrals, and it's not terribly too hard. It's a pretty easy concept, because you're just moving exponents around, it's a little bit of a different math. And that's what I'm trying to get at, is you get into more and more different types of math. So a mathematical universe goes into the whole concept that, like, when we get into different types of parallel universes, like, it's a totally different type of mathematics, totally different type of physics. And what they're doing is they're reducing universes basically down to their most basic constituent units. And when we go down to the most basic unit in all universes, all level universes, you get to mathematics, just pure mathematics. And when you get to that point, all of our universes are built in mathematics. So that is like the bare bones. That is like the bedrock of our reality. It's mathematics. It's pure mathematics. So that is, since that's where everything comes from, we should study that more often. The more we get a good grip on mathematics, the better we are at manipulating, at traversing, at looking at, observing, really taking in all of our reality. It's mathematical. Everything is mathematical. So, the more you know math, the more you know about life. Basically. So, to get at my original point of Gabriel's horn, it's something that I keep trying to picture, and it is basically the graph 1 over x. And it's like a big slope. It's like a big hill, a big scary skateboarding ramp that starts off super fucking high and then skates down into like a flat plane. That's 1 over x. As you know, I can explain this kind of how, like, when you graph things out, you basically graph things out on an xy plane. And so 1 over x, it's y equals 1 over x, right? So everything on the y plane corresponds to what you put into the function. And the function is 1 over x. So if I have an x of 1, it's 1 over 1. So the y isn't 1. If I have an x of 2, say we moved over to the 2 on the graph, it's 1 over 2, so it's at 1 half. Achoo! So that's just pretty much what it is. And it continues on like that. It goes from 1 half to 1 third to 1 fourth to 1 fifth, and so on. Achoo! only thing is that Gabriel's horn is that graph. That very simple graph, right? But it extends all the way to x equals 0. And the only thing is that whenever you get into 1 over 1 half, your y is actually a 2, because you actually flip the numerator and denominator when you do that. So 1 over 1 half is 2. 1 over 1 fourth is 4. 1 over 1 sixth is 6. As you can see, the thing exponentially rises when it gets closer and closer to 0, right? So that's going to set up for the problem that I'm going to say. It's stating that Gabriel's horn is 1 over x. It's the graph 1 over x from 0 to, pretty sure it's infinity. It's got to be infinity. And you rotate that graph in the third dimension. That's where it gets a little wonky. That's where I'm going to stop, because I feel like most people struggle with the first part. So I'm not going to get too heavy into that part. It basically makes a circle. You make a little circle with every point on the graph. And what that does is it makes a little shape. It makes a horn. And the thing is called Gabriel's horn. You do the equation for surface area, and it has an infinite amount of surface area. You do the equation for volume, it has a very defined volume. So here's the deal. You're taking something that is infinitely large, and it has a very fixed volume. It's called Gabriel's horn because it's like an attribute to the Bible. It's like some sort of like, it's some sort of analogy to the Bible. And what it is like Gabriel's horn is like the thing that they blow, the archangel blows when there's judgment day or something. It's the connection between the divine and the earthly. Right? So it's the connection between, like, the divine, the infinite, and the earthly, the finite. Because it has infinite surface area with fixed volume. My only thing is that if you approach zero, it should get, like, an infinitely big. It should continually grow. And it can never quite reach zero. Like, I get it. I totally get it. If we fix it at maybe one, then yeah, that would make sense, because the thing would continually grow in as it approaches infinity, right? It would still continually grow with its surface area, but the volume would be more and more finite. I could totally get that. The only issue is that when you bring it to zero, the volume increases as it approaches zero and continually approaches as it approaches zero. It continually increases. So I'm trying to think, like, whoa, what the fuck? Like, that totally throws a wrench in the whole idea and my ability to see it, because I keep seeing it growing as it approaches zero. I can't stop thinking about it, because I saw it on Instagram earlier, and I'm thinking, my God, how can that be? How can that be? And I keep thinking about it. And that's the thing, where, like, if you're interested in science, and math, and biology, anything of the sort, really, follow a lot of science-oriented pages on Instagram, on Twitter, on Facebook. The cool thing is, when you start scrolling on Instagram, when you start scrolling on Facebook, you'll just spontaneously learn something. Like, I often get into these little loops where I'll start scrolling through Facebook and I won't stop. And then I'll get to something science-oriented and I go, oh, that's interesting. Oh, wow, I didn't even consider that. I wonder if that's true, and I start Googling it, and then I go, oh, shit, I'm supposed to be doing something. I may as well do something while I'm on my computer, and then I get back into the whole habit of doing my homework. So I find that is an effective study habit if you all are interested in being more productive in your life. Then follow a bunch of science pages, and while you're at it, follow Eric Pullman. It's at ERICPUHLMANN, and I will post some sciencey stuff. So you will also get it from me. Haha. But I imagine if you're listening to this, you probably follow me on Instagram. But check it out. Check it out, ladies and gentlemen. And on that note, I'm probably going to stop because I've already dove in deep to random tangents when it comes to driving, when it comes to science, when it comes to, like, random shit that is on my mind. And I kind of want to listen to the rest of this Jordan Peterson book before I get to my destination. Currently listening to Jordan Peterson's Maps of Meaning, which is unbearably dense. It is so fucking dense. I have to rewind it so many times. But what it basically is Jordan is breaking down the whole structure of narrative and he's breaking down our ability to believe things, these maps of meaning. Basically the underlying mechanisms of our mind's ability to incorporate something into a meaningful experience. And he goes into things extremely deeply, and I really, it's like 30 hours long. It's a 30-hour long audiobook. And I'm like an hour in at this point, and I've only listened to, like, the foreword. So, it's extremely dense, and I am super ready to dive in heavily into this. But again, my name is Eric Pullman. I talk about anything from science to math to cool things in scientific discovery, philosophy sometimes. I'm kind of an armchair psychologist rather than like someone who actually studies it. But, you know, I'm familiar with utilitarianism, so, you know, like, I try my hand at it sometimes. But definitely not a philosopher. I talk about random things that have occurred, like not using your blinker. Don't be a stinker, ladies and gentlemen. Use your blinker. Thank you very much. The whole crowd was saying it. That was beautiful. Listen back. I guarantee no one's going to listen to this, but I figured that the more that I make these, the better I get at them. And the better I get at articulating my ideas on a public platform, the better I get at explaining my ideas in real life, in front of people, maybe in front of my the people that I tutor, you know, like, it's just, I become a more efficient individual when I put in meaningful work into something like this. And I'm glad that you listen if you do. If you don't, I don't really care either. Like, it's all good. If you want to turn it off at any point, I totally understand. You are more than justified to do that. This is like full of free associations and random tangents right now. So if you ever want to turn this off, don't feel bad. Do not feel bad. Please turn it off. This is just my first initial starting podcast bits, and I will elaborate on them. I will expound upon them, if you will. And these things will become much more developed, and I'll have more people on the podcast who actually have quality things to say, and maybe even I might be guest on others. If you guys haven't heard it, please listen to my girlfriend Alexa Ruxtella. She goes by Alexa. She was just on this podcast. It was fucking fantastic. Like, I love listening to it. Check it out. It's Confessions of a Fit Chick. And she was actually guest starring on this podcast. And it was just such a breath of fresh air to, like, listen to her on a podcast as well. Because I can really see her going far when it comes to, when it comes to the fitness industry. So, I honestly cannot wait until she's on more podcasts like that and I can just listen to her, as much as I can. Cause, like, goddammit, I'm like her biggest fan. It's, I fucking love her. Like, she's so great. She's so kind-hearted. And she really has a lot to say. She's extremely intelligent when it comes to the fitness industry. So I love listening to her. And I really recommend that you listen to her as well, everyone out there. But again, thanks for listening. If you are a sponsor and you would like to be on the podcast at some point, if you want me to read a script, send a message to Eric Pohl 2, that's ERICPUHL2, the number 2, at gmail.com. I'll read a script for you. Little small businesses, I'm here to help you, especially in the St. Louis area. I want to get names out there if possible. But yeah, thanks for listening, ladies and gentlemen. You have a fucking wonderful day. Stay scientific and stay classy.